Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 137, Buddhist Happiness, February 8th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Happiness has quite a specific meaning. It doesn't necessarily mean pleased. We often, I think, equate pleased with happy. Things are going my way. I feel pleased. That's good. I'm happy. This is a kind of happiness that means the mind and the heart engaged in a warm way with oneself, with other people, with people we know, with people we don't know, with the whole world, actually. And I do, in fact, define happiness as the ability to engage in warm relationship.
Happiness as the ability to engage in warm relationship. So says my guest, Dr. Sylvia Boorstein. Sylvia Boorstein, PhD, has been teaching meditation since 1985 and teaches both Vipassana and Metta meditation. She is a founding teacher of Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Marin County, California. She is also a senior teacher at the Insight Meditation Society in Bear, Massachusetts. She writes a regular column for Shambhala Sun and lectures widely. She's a psychotherapist, wife, mother, and grandmother who is particularly interested in seeing daily life as practice. Her latest book is Happiness is an Inside Job, Practicing for a Joyful Life. Her previous books include It's Easier Than You Think, Don't Just Do Something, Sit There, That's Funny You Don't Look Buddhist, and Pay Attention for Goodness Sake. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Sylvia Boorstein, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, you've been teaching and writing about Buddhist meditation for more than 25 years, and you're also a psychologist and a psychotherapist. Were you a psychologist first before you discovered meditation?
I was, actually, and that's an interesting part of the story, too. I began to be a psychotherapist, I guess, in my early 30s. I think I was 31 when I got my first job after graduate school. And I was 41 when I went on my first Buddhist meditation retreat and won a whole other area of exploration. If you want to go that way, that people often ask me, is how did my psychotherapy change as a result of my meditation practice, and if so, how?
Well, you're anticipating a question that I have in front of me, but I wanted to cover a couple of other things first. So you were a psychologist first, and actually you and I spoke offline just a little bit ago, and you told me that originally you were a licensed clinical social worker, and then you went on to get a PhD in psychology.
I did. And in fact, I went to social work school because in a surprise turn of my life, because my undergraduate degree is in chemistry and mathematics.
Oh, my goodness.
That's really, and the way I got there is I got my degree in chemistry and mathematics. I was married when I graduated from college. I had a child soon after that, and then three more children in the next 5 years. And in those 5 years, my husband had finished medical school, and he had his psychiatric residency. And I got very interested in the kinds of things that he was studying that were no part of my undergraduate experience. I had very little background in psychology. So that was one part of how my interest in working with the mind and levels of happiness or clarity came about. And the other part, which is probably more to the point, is after the birth of my fourth child, I really had a difficult time psychologically myself. It was a hard time. I had four young children. My mother had died not long before. I was, at that point, 25 years old. It was a hard time. And that was my first experience with looking for psychotherapy for myself. And it was so helpful to me that I really wanted to do that and be helpful to other people.
Okay. So then moving down the timeline a bit, tell us about how you first got involved with meditation and what attracted you to it.
Well, again, it was a serendipitous meeting of where I was in my life and the outside times. I became interested in meditation in the 1970s, when meditation had become really popular in the United States for the first time. People who are old enough will remember that the first major interest in meditation was interest in TM, and that came about because the Beatles had studied with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and introduced TM, and it was introduced into the larger culture as being good for your health and good for your blood pressure, good for your nerves, and so large numbers of people were interested in becoming initiated into practices of meditation, specifically into TM. And soon after that, I think that interest broadened into other kinds of meditations, and there was a proliferation of meditation practices that were available. I used to joke about the fact that my husband, who was in some ways far more the spiritual adventurer than I was, would go off, it seemed to me, every weekend to get initiated into some other new contemplative form, and often came home and said, "Phil, this is it. You should try it." And often I did. And in truth, I was interested in the things that I tried, but none of them really held my attention or spoke to me as decisively as mindfulness meditation, which I learned from teachers who had studied with teachers in the Buddhist tradition. Mindfulness is the central practice that the Buddha taught. And it was, in fact, my husband who had gone off on a retreat, come home and said, "So, this is great, you should try it." And I tried that and never left.
Okay, now what is it that distinguishes mindfulness meditation from some of the other Buddhist schools?
Well, I think it was, for me, certainly an accessible meditation. Mindfulness really is, in its own self, non-parochial. It doesn't require a belief system or a cosmology. It didn't require of me that I become a Buddhist. It's really a mind training practice that, when I define it, I talk about mindfulness as being the balanced moment-to-moment acknowledgement of one's experience, both inner and outer. What's going on right now? What's going on out here? And what's going on in me as I am aware of whatever is arising in this moment? And the fact that it's meant to be the balanced recognition is already the hint that it's a practice that aims at equanimity. We are all the time, I think, challenged by surprises in our life experience. It's not a mistake that life is difficult. Actually, when the Buddha really expounded his understanding of the cause and the end of suffering, he started by saying life is suffering, which actually is an inaccurate, not exactly correct translation of the Pali. Really, it's meant life is continually challenging because it's always changing and always presenting us with new situations, some of which are really difficult, some of which are a little difficult, some of which are considerably difficult. And the balanced recognition of, oh, this is happening. What would be a good thing to do now? This is happening. This is how I feel about it. What would be a wise response is really what mindfulness is about. And in some way, the instruction really gives a hint of the goal, which is a mind that's balanced enough to be able to hold itself in a certain amount of equanimity and make wise choices.
Was there a certain moment when you realized that this was your path? And if so, how did you know?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story, and I'll be glad to tell it to you, because I only knew it ex post facto. My first experience of mindfulness meditation retreat, which was an intensive 14-day retreat held in silence, was not remarkable until the very end of it. If someone had asked me on the 12th or the 13th or even the 14th day, are you much changed from this regimen of sitting quietly and walking slowly, paying attention moment to moment, not talking to anybody for 2 weeks? Are you changed? Do you know more? You know, what's happened? I would have said not much has changed, you know. I think that the line about cleansing the doors of perception makes sense to me. Colors looked a little brighter. The leaves looked a little sharper. The food tasted a little bit more tasty or more clear. I could smell what was for lunch a far distance from the dining room. But if someone had said, is this a reason to take up a discipline of practice, I don't know that I would have been so moved by it. I very much was moved by my teachers telling the story of the possibility of a mind that could abide in peace, abide balanced in a life that was continually challenged. The story of the possibility of peace moved me very much, but I don't know that that was a decisive element. It happened that on the last evening of that retreat, after the understanding of silence had been ended, we had a ritual, and people visited with each other. I chose to make a phone call and call home just to check with my husband about my schedule for arriving home and which plane I was coming on. And in the course of that phone call, I inquired after the health of my father, who at that time was 65 years old and had been in very good health, actually excellent health. He was an athlete, lived down the street from us, and he and I had a very close relationship. I am the only child of an only child, and we had a very close friendship. He was very dear to me, and just before I had left on that retreat, he had been feeling unusually peaked, and I knew he had a doctor's appointment. And so when I said, how's my dad? My husband said, well, I'm sorry to tell you, but he has a cancer, and it's not one for which there's a cure. And so here I am in a phone booth, you know, several states away, and I'm always, when I tell the story to people, I'm very careful to say I felt so sad, lest anyone think that there's something about meditation that distances people from their affect. I felt so sad to hear that was happening. But, you know, my previous experience of hearing dreadful news had been, in addition to feeling sad, feeling frightened, actually feeling sometimes so stunned, feeling faint, or feeling like I'd fall over or fall through the floor. And I felt myself hear it quite steadily. I felt sad. I felt terrible. But there was a part of my mind that I knew was thinking, okay, I wonder how we'll do this. We'll just do this together. And I left the phone booth, and I remember sitting down to have evening tea with people and not telling them my story. They were all talking with each other. And I thought to myself, this is very odd. I'm sitting here having a cup of tea. I've just heard that my father's going to die probably in a couple of years. And I'm having tea with people. I'm sitting here having tea. And afterwards, I went home and took up my life. And, in fact, the story of my father's illness unfolded. And I was with him through it and through his death as well. But when I look back, I realized that in that moment, I knew that my mind was different than when I had arrived at that retreat. And I thought it was such a piece of grace in my life to have received that news with my mind just at that point. Had I heard it before I'd left on that retreat, I don't know that I would have heard it with as much clarity and as much security that I could do that, really. I don't know if I would have been able to hear it the same 2 weeks later, but there it was, just a piece of very good fortune. And maybe I would have stayed with this practice without that. I really liked what my teachers promised, but it's as if I had heard the promise but hadn't really gotten it in my own body. And perhaps now that I'm telling you the story, maybe I get it, that I really corroborated that promise in my own body at that time, which is not to give the idea that I lived my life in equanimity since that moment, because it isn't about living in equanimity. It's about cultivating the mind of balance and then recultivating it when it's lost.
Okay, so you felt the sadness, but you also had this inner balance, this inner peace. And the promise of the teaching, from what you've said, sounds like it was about peace, and yet many people seem to stress enlightenment. So I'm wondering, what's your take on that, you know, that on enlightenment? And is it a process or an end state? And how does that relate to the kind of peace that you're talking about?
Well, I'll tell you first about the kind of peace that I'm talking about, because it's a particularly important, it is for me the most important understanding of what the Buddha taught. The kind of, in the paradigmatic story of the Buddha's enlightenment, when he sat down under the Bodhi tree and held his mind in balance and said, I will not move from this place until I have understood the cause and the end of suffering. I'm sure many of your listeners will know that story, or at least they will now.
Mm-hmm.
He sat through the night, assailed by all the forces that can confuse the mind, all the forces of afflictive emotions that can confuse the mind. And he sat through them all with complete and dignified, steady equanimity. And in the story about it, he makes the promise. He says, I see these forces coming to get me, and I am not afraid. And in the pictures of it and in the legends about his enlightenment experience, he's shown to be protected by a tremendous shield that in the drawings show all these spears and arrows of afflictive emotions coming towards him and turning into flowers and falling around him. I think it's the metaphor for what our own minds can do when we are assailed with potentially upsetting events, and the ability of the mind held in goodwill is what the story says. Not only did he sit with equanimity, but he sat with the counterpoint of equanimity, which is benevolence, which is goodwill, which is the ability to wish well unstintingly to all beings at all times. The counterpoint, the balance, the other side of equanimity, as it manifests in how we behave in the world, is that it produces a mind that wishes well, a mind of unbroken benevolence. And that actually is what's very appealing to me. That always has appealed. I think it's actually, when you think about it, what appeals to people now about Buddha's teachings, even people who don't know much about it, who see the pictures of the Dalai Lama or read about the Dalai Lama, somehow they intuit from what they hear him say, or even his very visage as it's shown in photos or stories about him, that he has something about him that radiates out, that sort of calms the atmosphere, that keeps him a contented and happy person, even though his own life has been assailed with difficulties. And the idea that that's a possibility. So I was not so much looking for myself for peace. As I could have articulated it, I would have said, I want to have a kind of mind and heart that are unafraid in life. I want to not be afraid. And I wanted to manifest myself in a way that seemed unfrightened.
Okay, well, I'm sure you're aware that there's an increasingly popular movement within psychology called positive psychology, which is emphasizing the study of happiness. And I've got your most recent book right here in front of me, which is titled Happiness is an Inside Job, Practicing for a Joyful Life. So What is the Buddhist view of happiness? Maybe that's what you've just told us, but...
I think so, you know. I've been thinking about it a lot. By the way, I love this book. I think it's the best book I've written.
All right.
I do. I've been talking about it a lot these days, and I'm so pleased with it. And I'm so pleased to be talking to you about it, too. Happiness has quite a specific meaning. It doesn't necessarily mean pleased. We often, I think, equate pleased with happy. Things are going my way. I feel pleased. That's good. I'm happy. This is a kind of happiness that means the mind and the heart engaged in a warm way with oneself, with other people, with people we know, with people we don't know, with the whole world, actually. And I would really, I do, in fact, define happiness as the ability to engage in warm relationship, and that the warm relationship that I'm thinking about, which in fact is the reflection of equanimity, that warm relationship is either compassion or friendliness or appreciation, depending on the situation, because sometimes there are difficult situations that we come upon, difficult situations, painful situations. Can't say, well, I'm happy, pleased about this, I'm happy about this. But when I am in my most clear self, if I come upon a difficult situation or I hear some difficult news, if I'm able to relate to it in a way that addresses it or does something for it that's helpful, then I'll feel better. I think human beings feel better when they feel helpful, when they feel friendly, when they feel generous. I think that's generally that the health research that you thought, that the happiness research that you talked about is actually showing that gratitude and generosity and relevance seem to be the pillars of happiness. We feel engaged in the world, connected.
Yes, and forgiveness, too, I would add to that.
And forgiveness, in fact, that anything that keeps us connected to the world, because not forgiving is holding someone or something at a distance. If I am not forgiving, that means that there's something that I'm still so mad about. It's as if I'm stuck in the view I cannot be happy unless so-and-so apologizes or this and that happens. And as soon as I say I cannot be happy unless, then I really cannot. You know, that if I, the opposite of that, or the contrast to that, is to say, this isn't what I wanted, and I wish that hadn't happened. But things happen, sometimes things that we really don't like. This whole book, really, I'm sure you've seen, is a book of stories about how the mind gets challenged when things don't go its way, and how, out of wisdom, it retrieves its balance and expresses itself in compassion and friendliness and appreciation, rather than out of disdain or jealousy or envy or enmity.
I'm struck by the fact that the way that you're describing happiness revolves around relationship, warm and caring relationship, when I think many people probably hold an image of meditation as very introverted and almost kind of isolationist. You know, it's burlesque as staring at one's navel. And it sounds like you're talking about something that's very different from that.
Well, I am, actually. To whatever degree, I know that, by the way, I know that stereotype about meditation, but I think that to whatever degree people even take on a contemplative practice that is for some period of time every day, maybe, themselves, or quiet, or non-relational in an outer way that anybody else could observe. There are two things I want to say about that. One is it's on behalf of them being able to go out into the world and do something in the world and interact with it. And the other is I actually think of my meditation practice as being my whole life. Sometimes it's intensive meditation practice, and I'm by myself, or it's time set aside, and I'm in my house or wherever I am, and I'm sitting quietly with the intention of cultivating balance and equanimity in my mind. But other times I'm going about my life all day long and in the supermarket or on the freeway, or and also practicing mindfulness. And maybe that's even the more important part of the practice, because I'm doing more of my practice moving around in the world than I am being by myself. And I think it's definitely both on behalf of the whole world as it is on behalf of myself. Because to the degree that I can notice the world out there and connect with it and really see it in wisdom. You know, when I said earlier on when we started to talk, and I said the Buddha based his whole practice on his insight that life is really difficult for everyone. And you know, what I think is that to the degree that I get that, whenever I rediscover that, I'm kinder and I'm nicer to people, and then I feel better, even people I don't know, or people as well as people that I do know. And I think it all depends on wisdom, not on, you know, the state of activity, whether I'm sitting in a contemplative mode at home or out on a muni bus or in an airplane. It depends on being able to look and maintain a certain amount of wisdom about what's true. And what's true is that everyone is challenged, everyone is heroic, everyone is doing the best they can. You know, one of the students in one of my classes some years ago said what I think is the best teaching line ever. Somewhat, we were talking about the fact that people are always challenged, and that the idea of a contented life and a contented and peaceful mind didn't depend on having everything fall out exactly the way you wanted it to do, because it never would, but on being able to accommodate however it was falling out. So someone joked and said that when we meet each other somewhere in the supermarket and we see each other, we say, "How are you?" And the other person says, "I'm fine." That "I'm fine" would mean I've got my share of challenges, just as everybody does, but I'm managing them, which we thought was a great idea. And then somebody else said, a woman whose name is Gwen, so we always call it Gwen's wisdom. Gwen said, I don't say I'm fine. She said, when anybody says, "How are you, Gwen?" I say, "I couldn't be better, because I couldn't."
Hmm.
And isn't that really remarkable?
Yes, yes, I like that.
Isn't that good? She said, because even when I'm suffering and I'm crabby or I'm unpleasant, I couldn't be better, because if I could, I would. Nobody purposely suffers. And that so struck me then, and I love to tell it to people, because when I remember that about people, even people who are annoying me, people who are behaving in ways that I wish they weren't, if I remember Gwen's wisdom about they couldn't be better, they could, they would if they could, I become more tolerant. It's really been fun teaching this. I have a good time teaching this. Really about saying that it's not about withdrawing from the world, but really engaging with it. I, just as everybody else, feel excited when things go well, and I feel disappointed when things don't go well. The idea that people who meditate have such tranquility that nothing moves them is, I think, the furthest thing from what the Buddha meant. I think that equanimity is not tranquility, it's not calm. It's a full and total engagement in the world with some balance, enough balance to maintain clarity and wisdom.
Well, I like the way that you keep that balance and take into account our human frailty.
Well, you know, I think that's true. It's extremely easy. I love to tell people stories about how extremely easy it is to forget what you know. I mean, we all of us know things pass in the spirit of a whole life. This particular incident doesn't matter. You know, you can put anything in the place of this particular incident. It will pass. The same sorts of things that our grandparents used to say that sounded like old people things, like, you know, don't cry over spilt milk, and this too shall pass.
Yes.
And, it's not the end of the world.
Right.
The kind of things that a grandmother would say to a young child, and you think, oh, they're just old. But I think actually those are the kinds of wisdoms that we all have in us, and we forget. This whole book is just, as you know, a compilation of stories about how easy it is to forget and techniques for getting it together again so that we remember.
Yes. Let's go back to your earlier question. How has experience with Buddhism and meditation impacted or informed your work as a psychotherapist?
I would say this. I would have said different things if you'd asked me 5 years ago, 10 years ago, probably. I think I am so respectful of how hard it is to be a person,
mm-hmm.
to continue on in a life with whatever kinds of things happen to us. The people who come to talk to therapists are people who are in pain about something in their life. Something has hurt them enough to look for help. And I think maybe I have less of a sense that, which I might have had when I was a young therapist, that I know what will help them. I don't have so much of a sense that I know what particular technique to do that will undo some particular thing. I don't know. But I am pretty sure that if I am able to be present and really listen to people so that they know really, really that I'm hearing what they're saying and that I care about them and what they're saying, that something happens in that caring envelope, in that relationship. Even you don't have to mention it. It just exists in the relationship, in the room together with the person. It's kind of, I think it provides the context in which one's own mind, mine as well as the person who's come to see me, relaxes, and one's own wisdom reinstates itself. Sometimes the wisdom is very often, I think you'll agree, the wisdom that comes up in people's minds about whatever it is that has happened to them in their life is, this or that happened, I wish it hadn't, it was painful, it hurt me in this or that other way, but that was then, and now is now, and everybody was doing the best they could. It wasn't very good, but it was the best they could. Recrimination and anger is just going to make my life worse now that I have whatever rest of my life left to do. How can I do it in a way that is warm and caring, not with other people only, but also with myself? How can I forgive myself for having struggled in my life, for making some choices that turned out to be unwise, for doing some things that I feel ashamed of? I think I've really become much kinder as a person. My husband will say, when he hears me say that, he says, you know, you were always kind. But I truly, truly think I've become kinder. And I think that the therapeutic alliance is one in which that works, is one in which the client really senses that they're truly held in love and they feel better.
In some ways, that sounds like Carl Rogers.
Does it?
Yeah, well, you know, he was shooting for that same thing. I think maybe the Buddhist practice helps you to get into the state of mind where you're able to do that.
Yeah, I think so. And it does sound like Carl Rogers. And, you know, I would say maybe what's changed is, first of all, I have more of an appreciation of people. Whatever they're suffering with, they came by it lawfully. Things happen to them. And if I keep myself really present by not distancing myself. Sometimes when you work with people in therapy, you feel this is happening to them, not to me. Or there's a sense of distance, sometimes even a sense of dismay that maybe I can't help this person, or a little bit of anxiety about, will I be able to help this person, which backs you off mentally,
mm-hmm.
and emotionally from the person. I think it's about not backing off. I think it's about being able to stay present even in difficult circumstances, so that the other person knows that you are really there, not only for them, but with them. So it's not something, it's a, really a joint enterprise, the therapeutic enterprise.
Yes.
And that we both come out better for it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've been interviewing a lot of therapists from different perspectives, and I've been getting the impression that mainstream psychotherapy is getting closer and closer to the Buddhist point of view. I'm thinking of things like cognitive behavioral therapy and the whole cognitive movement are recognizing the importance of our thoughts and our beliefs, and that it can be harmful to cling to fixed ideas and expectations. Does that make any sense to you?
Exactly so. You know, the Buddha said, as you know, in this book, I've talked about mindfulness and concentration and effort as the three key teachings of the Buddha in terms of reorienting the mind to balance. And I think that there's a very strong connection between cognitive therapy and the idea of noticing those thoughts in the mind that lead to unhappy feelings and that lead to distress, and actually noticing them as they arise and challenging them. This is not true. I'm putting that down. I'm not doing it that way. The Buddha said that wise effort as a trainer of the mind was diligence moment to moment about what's the climate of my mind, what's come into it. And if what's come up in it is wholesome and leads to happiness, then I'll nurture it there. If it's unwholesome, let me put it down right now. I teach a lot about being vigilant in myself for the very beginning of what might be growing into an unwholesome state. It sounds like an old-fashioned term, but here's an example. If I'm I'll make up one now instead of one from the book. But suppose I'm driving home from work and at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, and perhaps I've been in a group meeting with my colleagues, and I'm driving home, and I suddenly think to myself, I wish so and so shouldn't have made that remark about what I said. That wasn't such a good thing to say. And then I catch my mind getting a little tense about it and a little irritated in retrospect, and then beginning to hatch a little revenge fantasy. Maybe when I get to work tomorrow, if I see that person, I just won't be so warm to them. And then maybe they'll realize that they said something that was a little off yesterday. And it's just the wee beginning of a revenge fantasy. If I'm alert enough to the beginning of that and I catch it, I can think to myself, what are you doing, Sylvia? You know, it happened. You're driving home. You are filling up your mind with vengeful thoughts. Anger really is upsetting to the mind, to everything in the body. You'll go tomorrow, and maybe you'll take this person aside and have a discussion about it in a kind and open way. But there's no point at this point to foment this indignant, righteous indignation. Righteous indignation is one of the things that catches the mind, and I myself have discovered how invigorating it sometimes feels, but actually it's enervating, it's tiresome, and it fills the mind with an unhappy fog. And when talking about what's going to be in the direction of happiness, it's not in the direction of happiness. So I think there's a great deal it challenges a lot of psychotherapy that we knew 20 or 30 years ago, which has dwelt in the past and bringing it up and re-feeling difficult feelings of past times. It's not to say that it's not important in therapy to know what happened to people and to let them talk about it and to feel it and to, you know, register the appropriate sense of having empathized with their distress. But I think it's very important to notice at what point the revival of ancient acute feelings of distress doesn't serve anymore. Mm-hmm. It actually makes the mind in the habit of feeling embittered.
Yes, I totally agree. Your books have such intriguing titles, and one of the ones from a while back that you wrote is, "That's funny, you don't look Buddhist." And I know that's a play on the old saw, "That's funny, you don't look Jewish." And I know that you're an observant Jew. How do the two, you mentioned earlier that what you liked about this approach was that it didn't require allegiance to a particular religion. I'm wondering, for you, how have Judaism and Buddhism come together for you?
Well, for me, it has been not a problem at all, since I was fortunate enough when I began my meditation practice to hear one of my teachers teach early the sermon that the Buddha preached to the people of Kalama. It's known very well as the Kalama Sutta. And he said to them, don't believe anybody who tells you anything, that even if it's a trusted friend or someone you heard of or someone who's acknowledged to be an important teacher, or even if you think it's a Buddha, don't believe anything until you practice it yourself. If you hear some ideas that are interesting to you, try them out. If it works, do them. If it doesn't work, let them go. It was so clear to me that it wasn't about becoming an anything. It was about learning techniques that might enhance my life. In fact, that particular book that you mentioned is a story of not so much how I managed to integrate two different religious traditions, because actually I don't think I've integrated two religious traditions. I think I'm a person who grew up as a Jew and enjoys being that and living in the context of that cultural and religious form. What happened for me is I had the good fortune to learn from people who learned from Buddhist teachers this really lovely non-parochial practice of attentiveness to the changing flow of mind events moment to moment, so that I could begin to relax in my life and feel better. The other teaching that we haven't mentioned, by the way, there were two twin focal teachings of the Buddha, the teaching of mindfulness and the teaching of loving kindness, which is really bringing attention all the time to wishing well and filling the mind with benevolent feelings. And they support each other. It was clear to me that I could learn those two, or it never occurred to me that it would be a problem to learn those two and just continue to live my life, not only as a Jew, but as a psychologist, as a Westerner, as a woman, as a social activist, as a political activist, as everything that I was, that it didn't challenge any part of my lifestyle. And I've been happy through the years to notice that people who have a hard connection to Judaism or to any denomination of Christianity or to any other religious practice have been comfortable coming to mindfulness and loving kindness retreats and lectures and workshops, and are able to work with the techniques that we teach, because in fact it not only not challenged my life as a Jew, but it enhanced it.
Well, I will be putting a link to your website so that if anybody wants to find out more about the workshops that you're teaching and the dates and times so on, they'll have access to that. We could go on for quite a bit longer. There's a lot more that I'd love to talk to you about, but I think we've probably taken about as much time as I want to impose upon my listeners. I wonder if there are any final thoughts that you'd like to leave us with.
Let me think 1 minute about that, because here it is, a final thought. You know, in the Zen tradition, more than in the tradition that I know, people have said to practice what is the pith core wisdom that they've learned and say it on their dying breath. So I very much hope not that breath. But here we are at the end of this broadcast. Let me think what I want to say. That I think it is possible. I have great faith that most... Okay, starting that sentence again. My great faith and trust and experience is that it's true for me, and I think for most people, that when our minds are not confused, we are, as human beings, caring, friendly, compassionate, appreciative, warm, companionable people, that that's what kind of beings we are, and that our challenge in life is to keep our minds unconfused so that we can manifest in that best possible way. My best hope for myself and for everyone and for the world and for the planet is that we'll, more and more of us, work more and more on unconfusing our minds so, in fact, we can actualize that potential of human beings to take care of each other and hold each other up in a great web and net of compassionate caring.
Well, that's an excellent closing breath for this broadcast. Dr. Sylvia Boorstein, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation on Buddhism with Dr. Sylvia Boorstein. I particularly like her down-to-earth, practical approach to spirituality that emphasizes simple virtues such as kindness to others and kindness to oneself. I also appreciate the humility that comes across in her book, revealing her own very human struggles to be as mindful as possible, with many slips and recoveries along the way. In this recent book on happiness, she writes, "Because we are human and have empathy built into our brain structure, when we are touched by what we encounter, and when our minds are balanced, we respond with benevolence, with friendliness, or compassion, or appreciation." Sylvia's emphasis on these simple virtues such as friendliness, compassion, benevolence reminds me of my interview with my good friend, Dwight Webb, in New Hampshire, who I interviewed about his book on the soul of counseling in Shrink Wrap Radio number 68. Dwight similarly emphasizes the traditional virtues as the essence of spirituality. By contrast to these two people, I'm always deeply distrustful of so-called spiritual leaders and gurus who drive big cars and are raking in huge amounts of money. I guess I'm deeply imprinted by my own early spiritual training with Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, where he warns of false prophets and wolves in sheep's clothing, saying, "By their fruits ye shall know them." I very much agree with Sylvia when she writes, quotes, "It is certainly true for me, and I think for most of us, that when I feel myself in caring connection, encouraging, consoling, or appreciating, I feel the twin pleasures of clarity and goodness. It doesn't matter if the connection I feel is to myself, or a person I know, or people I don't know, or even the whole world. The lively impulse of caring is what counts."
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind.
Somehow that struck me as the perfect musical transition for a show about meditation. As I mentioned last time, I'm going to be in Barcelona in early May, and I would love to meet with one or more of you there. Checking on our Frapper map, I see that I did hear from one listener there in Barcelona. Esther, are you still out there? Maybe we could get together for a cafe, and you could give me some tourist tips or show me around a bit. I'd sure like that. Speaking of our Frapper map, let me welcome prolific programmer in Beirut, Lebanon, who writes, "Sometimes in Ireland, sometimes in San Francisco, sometimes in Beirut." I had heard prolific programmer a number of times on Adam Curry's podcast, The Daily Source Code. So I felt like I knew him a little bit already, and or know him a bit already, and I'm grateful to discover that he's a listener. And sometime not too long ago, I think he and I connected on Skype to discuss a possible programming project. So, Mr. Prolific, thanks for putting yourself on our Frapper map. And if you're not on our Frapper map, please add yourself. You'll find a link on our website. I have a new interview up on my Wise Counsel podcast at wisecounselpodcast.com. The interview is on parents and teens and issues surrounding teen dating with my friend Annie Fox. If you're a teenager yourself or the parent of teens or you work with teens, I think you'll find this an interesting interview. Annie's a great resource person, and she has a couple of wonderful websites which are also full of resources for parents and teens. I've really been enjoying a new dramatic series on HBO called In Treatment. It's about a psychotherapist and four of his patients. It's based on a series that originally appeared in Israel, and it's the best media depiction of psychotherapy that I've seen outside maybe of Robin Williams and Good Will Hunting. And amazingly, you can currently download the episodes from the iTunes store for free. And I don't know how much longer these free episodes will be available. So if I were you, I'd jump on them right away. Or else subscribe to HBO. And no, this is not a paid sponsorship. The sponsors for this show, in fact, are Podshow and GoDaddy. And thanks to all of you who've bought domain names and such at GoDaddy and use the discount codes on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. Those discounted purchases help to support this show. Brace yourself now for a rather different transition sent in by a listener in Ottawa, Canada. It's reggae. I think we have a Rastaman up there in Canada.
Big up Dr. Davey Shrink Wrap Radio. Yes, me listen fi him man wherever I go. No matter if me in California or city or Toronto, me must listen to the Dr. David flow. Big up Dr. David and psychology that'll give me the stress-free psychotherapy. The best thing of it, man, is that me pay no money to tune in every day and weekly. Big gum that the Dave, you man, all of the rage. Big gum that the Dave, yes man, you are the rage. Big gum that the Dave, yeah, now you all of the rage. A bad guy, you must say. Hey. Yeah man, big enough, Dr. Dave, each and every time. Coming to you from Bad Guy, up here in Canada, Ottawa. The baddest man on the radio providing us with the psychiatric / psychological flavor. Me love it! Big up Dr. Dave!
Well, me didn't understand all of it, but me love the energy of it. Me feel the love! So thanks to the mystery Rastaman up there in Canada. And with that, we'll move to some email. First, I want to acknowledge a couple of emails from Nir Ben Zion, the creator of our Shrink Wrap theme music at the beginning and end of the show, who wrote to alert me to the In Treatment series on HBO, and then wrote again letting me know I could download it for free from the iTunes store. So Nir, thanks for that tip. I've really been enjoying the series. I received a nice long email from Joni, also known here as Honey Rococo, as she has signed herself a few times in the comments area. And since it's long, I'll just read the last part in which she comments on the recent show about teaching parents and toddlers to communicate using American Sign Language. She writes, "The sign language for baby show is really good, too. I have liked the idea ever since I first heard about it some years ago. When you think about all that frustration humans store up from not being able to communicate in those first months of life, I imagine that it would be like going to France, which she did, and not being able to speak any French at all, and really wanting something you had no words for. I speak halfway decent French, and it was still frustrating at times trying to express myself. So imagine that psychic / somatic states of wanting and needing are pretty much the whole of your newborn existence, and yet there's no way to get anything except for crying. an activity that in itself makes you hot, makes your eyes tear up, and makes it hard to breathe when all you want is your mother's breast or a toy you dropped, etc. That must be why everyone is such a mess as an adult. Okay, happy year of the rat. Love, Joni. Joni, thanks for that email and all the others that you've written. I feel so guilty. Your emails are so long and so smart and complete, and mine are barely more than grunts in reply. But I do appreciate them and look forward to perhaps meeting you now that you're in the Bay Area for a while. Now, John in Canada posted a good review for Shrink Wrap on iTunes, but it turns out that I can't see the Canadian iTunes site. Still, I'm planning to send him a book. And as part of our book negotiation, he wrote to me, Dr. Dave, I have just contacted Dr. Amy Baker. I interviewed Amy Baker on Wise Counsel. And he says, I've just contacted Dr. Amy Baker and have ordered a copy of her book on parental alienation syndrome. In terms of my interests, I have two jobs. I work for Family Services, and I'm now working with a family of a targeted parent. I also work at a residential treatment center for youths suffering from addictions. Our program is based on a therapeutic community model. My main interest is in psychotherapy and counseling theory and practice. I was thinking to get another of James Bugenthal's books. I have read The Art of Psychotherapy. I heard you discussing him in a previous show and thought to revisit him. Hope that helps, John. John, that does help. I'll send you a book, but it may not be as highly targeted as we would wish. I don't have anything right now that's directly on target, but I can send you something you might be able to loan to your clients or to use with them. And Jim Bugenthal is one of my heroes, as I may have mentioned. Be sure to listen to my interview with Irving Yalom, MD, on Wise Counsel after the middle of this month. Like Bugenthal, he's another eminent psychotherapist of the existential persuasion. Next, we hear from Nancy, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been listening to your show for a long time now, catching up on past episodes. Every time I load up my iPod, Shuffle, or Nano with podcasts, I take 8 to 12 episodes of your show among the rest and have gradually been whittling the number down. After I passed your 100th show, I finally put myself on your Frapper map. When I heard you mention for the first time that not all the shows were currently on the podcast, I felt relatively certain that at that time I started listening, I had started at 1. Now that I'm nearly up to date, I decided to make sure of this and have found that those early shows are not familiar to me, and so we'll start in on them soon. Yes, let this be a reminder to any new listeners that our feed doesn't have all the shows. It drops off the earlier shows, so to start at number 1, you need to go into the archives on the site. And Nancy continues, Your show sets itself apart from others because you present such a wide range of techniques and approaches. You ask questions that help the guest present their topic and draw out their interest and passion for the subject, and it's always interesting. I also appreciate the time you take with each and the depth that allows for. Some listeners have complained that you present topics that are not fully researched or founded in science. However, that is exactly one of the things I really appreciate about your show. So I say, keep up the good work. That is the area where the parameters of the field are growing most quickly and productively. I suppose I'm biased in that view because I myself am a proponent of some of those unresearched techniques. I'm a psychotherapist, actually a registered art therapist, a master hypnotherapist, a master practitioner of NLP, and an advanced practitioner of EFT, now in private practice. By the way, listeners, EFT stands for Emotional Freedom Technique. She says, You have addressed all these things at some point in your show. One of your listeners expressed some doubt about EFT, and I would just like to say that I've experienced its effects for myself and seen countless times what it can do for clients. Often troublesome issues that have been plaguing a person for years just melt away with several rounds of tapping. I'm not trained in EMDR, but I have experienced it and find that the effect it has is much the same as that of EFT. And I find that EFT has the added advantage that it is easy for a person to learn and use in between sessions for some of the simpler issues, which can help to speed the process of therapy along. I loved the series of interviews you did on different approaches to working with dreams. A major part of my own psychotherapy was with a Jungian analyst where we used dreams extensively, and I experienced their relevance and power firsthand. In my own practice now, I also work with dreams, but in a somewhat different way. I don't interpret, but work with hypnosis and with a person in a trance, guide them back into the dream to dream it differently, and resolve the dream in a more positive and active way. This can have a profound effect because we are working directly with the content of the unconscious mind. Of course, in this work, all the same principles that apply to interpretation apply, in that what the client wants and their own view remains paramount, and I'm not leading, but guiding, a step behind rather than in front. I was just listening to your live show as you were talking about hypnagogic phenomena, and would just like to mention that I've always done that, looking with eyes closed, and I've always found it very relaxing and quite entertaining sometimes. Many years ago, if I was quite tired and closed my eyes and looked, I would see a whole lot of cartoons, sometimes patterned into one another, sometimes just single things like a little bird wearing large boots splashing about in a puddle. I would follow these images into sleep, and so could fall asleep easily, even in the presence of very loud noises, like my ex-husband in the next room playing drums and jamming with several other musician friends with guitars and so on. Well, that's quite a good trick. Once an image in a hypnopompic state brought back a deeply buried memory from when I was about 2 or 3 years old. So I do find this kind of thing quite fascinating indeed. Also, in the same show, you mentioned the Sonoy Society and their use of dreams. It was from what I had learned about that approach that led me to do the kind of hypnotherapeutic dream work that I do. I've recently finished recording a couple of guided hypnosis sessions, which I'm selling on my website, innovativehypnotherapy.com, and if you're interested, I would be happy to give them to you for free so that you could listen to them, and if you like them, give them a plug on your show. Let me know if you're interested, and I will send you the link to download them. I'll be leaving a recommendation for your show on iTunes as well. You'll see it under my sign-in name of Ryan. Keeps me coming back for more. Sorry this has gotten so long, but I would just like to say one more thing, that if you would like to do another show on EFT, more focused on practice and use of it, and or about my approach with dreams, I would be more than pleased to become a guest on your show as well as an avid listener. All the best, Nancy. Well, Nancy, that sounds like a very interesting proposition. Yes, I'd love to receive those tapes, and I will review them. And you just got a plug. I mentioned the website. And if I like the tapes, I'll plug them again. And I think you would make a very good guest. Let me suggest that, Nancy, that you give me a ring, okay? I've left a phone number on the website, and why don't you contact me? Let's chat a little, and then we'll line it up. And I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. You're encouraged to leave voice messages using the MyChingo button on our site. And that phone number is in the U.S., and it's 206-337-0622. And so thanks again to Dr. Sylvia Borstein for sharing about her new book on happiness from a Buddhist mindfulness perspective. And you'll want to hear next week's show, in which I will interview a Dutch psychologist about software that he has developed that does psychotherapy on you right on the net. You don't want to miss it. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.